Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James here with another installment of Christogenos with my guest host, William Fink. We're going to do part 8 of our Two Seed Line series. But first, I have a couple of quick announcements. Number one, for those of you who are celebrating Passover, I know those who celebrate the solar calendar, some celebrate Passover yesterday, some of them are celebrating today, and then there's all kinds of shades between the pure solar calendar and then the lunar solar calendar, and then the Muslims practice a purely lunar calendar, but of course they don't practice Passover, so forget about them. In any case, whatever form you practice, happy Passover to you. And my guest on Sunday is going to be Pastor George Udvari. We're going to be talking about his Bible study manual. And on that day, we are going to do a communion in honor of the Last Supper. And so that's going to be, we're going to open the show. Or maybe we should wait for a while, maybe toward the middle of the show so people can log in. In any case, my guest Sunday is going to be Pastor George Udvari, and we are going to hold communion during that show, and it'll start at 11 Central, 12 Eastern time, okay? And then we've been, Bill and I have been talking about this rampage that went on in Binghamton, New York, and it's very interesting that the media coverage would not identify the shooter. Apparently 15 people have been killed in a rampage in what was the bill again? It was a
immigration office.
Okay. And the first thing occurred to me, good evening, Gerald, good evening, everybody else. First thing occurred to me was a white guy got tired of all these immigrants and decided to plug a few of them. And it turns out the guy's an Asian. Okay. And that's why there wasn't any real serious media coverage. If it had been a white person doing the shooting, it'd be, you know, all over Timbuktu on nightly news by now. So nobody knows what the motive is. Probably he lost his job. I know that. He worked for IBM and lost his job. So we'll see what the details are on that later. But we're going to continue this evening. Oops, I got to get my Bible open here. In Genesis. A two seed line, and we've been, I think we left off at Genesis chapter 6, verse 9. Is that correct, Bill?
Did.
Okay. Do you have any comments before we actually get to verse 10 or things you want to say about the previous 9 verses?
Well, I can't. We discussed the giants. We discussed Genesis 6, 1 to 4, and my conclusion is that we should change sons of God to sons of heaven.
Okay.
In those verses. And the people at the time may have seen them as gods, and the later myths all say that those beings were gods.
Right.
And that's from a very earthly human perspective. The Bible, I believe, corrects that and tells us that Adam was the son of God, and
right,
the race of the children of God. And those beings, whatever they were to begin with, are the rebels, those who rebelled against God, and
mm-hmm.
Giants that grew out of that race-mixing episode, and it had to be a race-mixing episode in Genesis 6, 1-4, or there would not have been a problem with it.
Right, right,
giants
absolutely.
Giants that grew out of that, there are myths. If you read the Greek literature, like the Odyssey, in the Odyssey, in the ninth book of the Odyssey, it says that Poseidon fathered the giant Cyclops.
Okay.
So the race of the Cyclops, the Cyclops is actually a race, and there are specific Cyclopses named in the Odyssey.
Okay.
And that's probably a tale, but we see that the Greeks believed that the giants fought the gods, father giants on
mm-hmm.
the earth. If you look at the Heimskringla, which is ancient Germanic poetry, and Snorri Sturluson's edition of the Heimskringla talks about people of the race of giants.
Mm-hmm.
And mentions them quite often, and other Germanic literature does as well.
Yes.
And it also talks about Nibelungs, who are little dwarfs with lots of gold, and I think the Nibelungs are probably the Jews.
Right. Exactly.
The Akkadian literature also talks about gods fathering giants.
Mm-hmm.
So this Genesis 6 tale I mean, we could call it a tale. It's actually, the Hebrew version is probably the correct version of all of the myths.
Mm-hmm.
And the myths were rooted in, the origin of the myths were rooted in the same story that the Hebrew version is.
Yes, no doubt.
However, it was expounded upon and men, you know, devised stories out of the legend as time continued, because poetry was the entertainment, the only entertainment they had back then. They didn't have any other form
exactly.
of entertainment. And poets and bards were people that could recite long poems were in great demand and were special because, or considered special because they could entertain people.
Yeah, almost like Shakespeare.
Well, exactly. He's one of the last of the great bards, probably.
Yes, absolutely. yeah.
That would sum up my opinion of the mm-hmm. first several verses of Genesis
yeah.
chapter 6, and it's important to understand that, and it's important to understand how all these other stories from the other branches of our race,
mm-hmm.
the various branches of our race, they don't disprove the Bible, they substantiate it.
That's right.
Once you understand that all these people were white people and all of them had a common origin.
Yes, absolutely. Well, these stories of the flood, the stories of giants, stories of, titanic war in the ancient past, all of these things are common to virtually every, you know, surviving society on the planet, okay? So either they all had a common origin, or the story was spread out, you know, from one common origin to all these other places. But it's very obvious, and certainly in the case of giants, the archaeological evidence of gigantic, you know, 20-foot tall beings is there. You know, it's there. It's suppressed. It's not talked about. The evolutionists don't want to talk about it. The creationists don't want to talk about it. But you can go online and just type in giants, and you'll see all kinds of archaeological evidence of the fact that these giants did exist, okay? And so it's not a myth, folks. It's absolute reality, and it's something that both, you know, we have this false dichotomy between the creationists and the evolutionists, both of whom teach fairy tales, and the reality is just as the Bible says, there were giants in those days, and also after that, as we will get into when we talk about the descendants of Gath, okay? So there's simply no doubt that this is for real, folks. There were giants in the earth in those days. Now, let's just continue. At verse 9, these are the generations of Noah, because this is a very important verse here. These are the generations of Noah. Noah was a just man and perfect in his generation. Now, of course, the word generation means descent. It means lineage. It doesn't mean a bunch of people living together around the same time, and perfect in his descent means he was unblemished in his genealogy. Isn't that how you take it, Bill?
Well, right, and I have a few things to say about this verse because there is something problematical with it.
Okay.
Strong's Concordance, the word generations appears here twice in the King James Version of the Bible.
Yes.
And it should. Well, a word similar to it should. Let's put it that
way.
Strong's Concordance tells us that they both came from the Hebrew word toledah, which means descent.
Yes.
However, other biblical sources that I have, and I would like to believe that Strong's Concordance is correct, but BibleWorks and other programs like Libronix, they tell me that the second occurrence of the word comes from a Hebrew word dor.
Okay.
Which means to – I believe that the Latin durare comes from this Hebrew word dor,
okay,
which means to last, to endure, to stay, to abide.
Okay.
And dor in Hebrew is 1755. It could mean generation from a man's birth to the birth of his son, or it could also mean birth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, if Noah was, even if Noah's, this is the descent of Noah, and he was perfect in his birth, might be the legitimate reading of the
verse.
Okay.
Well,
now,
either way, genetic purity is implied.
Oh, absolutely, and either way, the Greek words that we use to render these in the Septuagint are genesis, or genesis,
yes,
which means origin or descent. And the second word is genea, which means race, kind, family, or origin.
Mm-hmm.
And very rarely it can be translated generation, but it means birth.
Yes.
It is what it means. Noah
yes.
was perfect in his race or in his birth.
Yeah, so we're definitely continuing the seed line saga here, because Noah is an Adamite. There's simply no doubt about that. We've traced Noah all the way from Adam. And, you know, we've been simultaneously tracing the Canaanites, and we'll get back to those another time. Can there be any possible doubt that these Adamites are nothing else other than white men?
Oh, there's no doubt at all. That's the, we saw last week in the apocryphal literature how Noah was the whitest baby they'd ever seen.
Right. Right. Yes. And yeah. Then, and that's probably what it means there, that Noah walked with God.
Right, and that, I believe, is a myth which grew from the fact that Noah was perfect in his birth. They idealized him and showed us what the ideal model of an Adamite was.
Yes.
The
yes.
whitest person you ever saw.
Right, right. Okay, so now in verse 10, now here is the famous verse where Even some in identity got this wrong. Let me read it anyway. And Noah fathered three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And the common teaching here, which is simply outrageous, is that Shem was white, Ham was black, and Japheth was Oriental. Is any possibility of that myth being, talk about myths, folks, where did that come from?
There is no, it comes from the idea that the Catholics, the Romish Church, felt that it had to squeeze the whole world in the Bible.
Yeah, right.
That the flood had to cover the whole planet, mm-hmm. and therefore everybody came from Shem, Ham, and Japheth, so we could all be Christians.
Right.
which is the beginning of all deception, right?
Sure.
There. I mean, that's, in Christianity today, that is the root of all deception.
Mm-hmm.
That the flood covered the whole planet, and therefore we all came from the same parents,
right.
according to the Bible,
yeah.
and according to the evolutionists.
Well, just in case we didn't all come from Adam and Eve, now we've got this. Now we've got this second microevolutionary event.
Well, right. They claim that the flood covered the whole world, and we all came from Shem and Ham yeah. and Japheth.
Right.
And it's really absurd.
Yes.
I mean, we could probably talk about it all day.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
The word Cam is everybody says it means black, but it doesn't mean black.
Mm-hmm.
It means hot.
Okay.
And the Hebrew word Kema means hot.
Okay.
And that's the word that we get the English word chemistry from.
Okay.
Okay, so there's another English from Hebrew word for you. And there are other intervening stages in Latin and Greek in between. But basically, that's what the word Cam means. It means hot. It doesn't mean...
Yeah, and the Hamites moved into a hot area called Egypt.
Oh, right. But the entire world was hot. The Greeks described themselves and all the people around them as the sunburnt races.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And all the people in the Near East, and it was always hot.
Yes.
And I wouldn't, the climate change, all right, it snows in Lebanon sometimes, but that doesn't mean it isn't as hot as Egypt the rest
right.
of the year.
Yes.
Lebanon's just a much higher elevation than Mount
yeah.
Lebanon. The Ham, he actually, I mean, if you want to see hot as hot with passion, he fulfilled that role.
Mm-hmm.
And his name is perfect in
yes.
that sense. Because we'll see when we get to Genesis chapter 9 what Ham's great mistake was.
Right, right.
The word doesn't mean black, and Farrah Fenton was wrong on that. And a lot of people, even in identity, love the Farrah Fenton translation. But, I mean, none of it, we're all human, and he could make mistakes too. And this is one of his big ones.
Uh-huh, interesting. Okay. All right. Now it says that verse 11, the earth also was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with vials. Now, of course, here's another example of the word earth. Now, I haven't looked it up here, but probably also translated as from Eretz, which is the word that says when we're getting into Noah's flood, that Eretz, and Eretz can mean land, it can mean dirt, it can mean planet, it can mean any of those things. depending on upon the context, and it almost never is translated as planet. It's a very, very rare translation, and we'll be talking about, you know, where it talks about the Earth being covered with a flood. So obviously, the Earth itself can't be corrupt. And here's an example of, you know, metaphorical language. Of course, it means all the people on the Earth were corrupt, and certainly we're talking about this area where Noah and his three sons and the rest of the people lived, you know, that were subject to the influence of these giants. Isn't that what we're talking about here?
Yes, absolutely. The flood didn't happen because of the evil people. The flood happened because of the good people.
Okay.
It happened to punish the Adamites.
Yeah.
From their evil.
Right.
But the word Eretz is translated land, I think it's like 1,500 times.
Here okay.
Land, meaning, it's Strong's number 776, and this is from the Enhanced Strong's lexicon, land, earth, the whole earth as opposed to a part, the earth as opposed to heaven, the earth as the inhabitants, the land, the country, the territory, the district, the region, all of these, as you said, are definitions of the word Eretz. And the word was translated land in the King James 1,543 times, and earth 712, and country 140, and ground 98.
Okay.
And then there's a couple of minor translations of just a couple here and there of varied wilderness and field.
Yeah.
However, it's clear that the context, if you look at the subsequent chapters of Genesis, we have Kenites. Kenites are the descendants of Cain, and they weren't on the ark.
Right.
We have Kenizzites and Kadmonites mentioned in chapter 15, Genesis chapter 15. They weren't on the ark, and they have no genealogy from Adam or Noah in Genesis chapter 10. Where did these people come from?
Right.
We have the Perizzites. They're mentioned throughout, from Genesis chapter 15, 34, throughout Exodus, Joshua, Judges, Chronicles, Ezra, and Nehemiah.
Yes.
Where did they come from? They didn't descend from Adam. They're not listed in Genesis chapter 10, and they're mentioned in Genesis chapter 15.
Right.
And
right.
We have the Rephaim survived the flood, and they're mentioned in Genesis chapter 14, Genesis 15, 1 and 1 Chronicles. Goliath was one of the Rephaim. It's very clear that the flood was a local flood because all these people survived it.
Yes.
They just weren't in the area of the flood.
Right. Okay. Yeah, because not everybody on the planet lived in the same territory.
Right. And we have other races that have absolutely no knowledge of this flood or any part in it.
Yes.
And the Indians of South America, the Incans and the Peruvians and the Chinese and the Mongols and all these, I mean, our blood spread out into these areas at an early time and mixed these people. And we brought our stories with us.
Right, right.
And that's why they have flood stories.
Yeah. Well, actually, the Chinese, their flood story says that the water filled up the Tarim Basin almost to the source of the Yellow River. So that's a very specific claim, you know, and that would make a lot of sense because my view is that the deluge was global. There was an episode of tremendous rainfall that did affect the entire planet, but also in the area where the Noahites lived, there was also an upwelling of water from underground, and that's not true of the whole planet. That's just true of the area where the Adamites lived.
Well, I don't know if your view can be substantiated, or we can even. I don't even think that we should argue about that.
Okay.
My point is that the flood was local.
Yes.
And it, you know, if an event such as this happens, it's going to impact a very much wider geographical area to a lesser extent.
Yes, exactly.
There's no doubt. I don't doubt that. But I don't know if we could substantiate from the Bible, history, and archaeology any one specific account of what happened at this time.
Let me back up to Genesis 4:14 because here's a perfect example of the word Eretz and how it's used. Behold, you have, and this Cain, after being driven out of the garden, behold, you have driven me out this day from the face of the earth. The same expression that we have here in Genesis chapter 6. Now, was Cain driven off the planet?
Oh, absolutely not. That's
of course
a shame
not.
Because all the Jews would be on the moon.
That's right. Space Jews.
Yeah. Jews aren't going to go to heaven either, I'm yes. sorry to say.
So it doesn't mean planet in Genesis 4:14. Why should it mean planet here? I mean, the creationists are hanging their whole thesis on this one mistranslated word. Okay? That's what they're doing. And they're demanding that this is the only possible translation of the word Eretz in this verse. And they're wrong.
Right, but you have the King James translators. They decided how they translate how to translate these words. And, you know, they're still believing in a flat earth theory.
Yes.
You know, they're not the most
scientific,
overthinking scientific people in
right.
In the world at the time.
Yeah. And
they still think the earth is flat. There's still arguments over that. The church is still insisting on it. They still have a geocentric picture of the universe. And there's a lot of problems. And they don't know where their race originated from.
Yeah. Yeah, and we also have to take into consideration the fact that the Protestant Revolution vis-a-vis the Catholic Church or the Vatican was still kind of in full swing, and like Martin Luther and others were changing their minds on Scripture because they were finally being able to read the Bible for themselves and being able to oppose Catholic doctrine, and this whole translation process was in a state of flux, and as you say, the Catholic Church held out for the flat Earth theory. killed Galileo, who suggested that the sun might be the center of the solar system and not the planet Earth. Et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. So what we're dealing with is a lot of guesswork on the part of the translators here. We can't take this as the translators, what's infallible knowledge, as some people would like to say.
Right, and Rome was still burning people at the stake for
yes.
beliefs as late as the 1860s or 1870s, I believe.
Right. So it was, people didn't make changes to the existing doctrine lightly, is what I'm trying to say.
Absolutely not.
Yeah, and so that's where this comes from, folks. In fact, the Jews teach the same thing. The Jews teach with the flood was global. Okay, let me continue here. Verse 12, and God looked upon the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted its way upon the earth. And God said to Noah, the end of all flesh is come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth. It's an interesting expression here. I will destroy them with the earth. Any thoughts on that expression there?
Well, the land it's clear in many parts of the New Testament that Yahweh looks as the land upon which great sins are committed as even becoming
yes.
Defiled and alienated and defiled.
Right.
And the story is that he's destroying the land along with the people.
Yes.
And even Sodom and Gomorrah, what did the ground do? But Sodom and Gomorrah, nothing was ever going to grow there again, and it's probably laying under the Dead Sea, most of it right
that's
now.
That's right. That's why the Dead Sea is dead.
Right.
Because of all that pollution that's underneath it.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
That land became vile to Yahweh also, and look at it.
That's right. That's
the
right.
The land is defiled, and Peter tells us that the next world is burned with fire, and that might be true in more ways than one.
That's right.
Yet happen literally.
Yeah, it's gonna get hot both politically and literally. Okay, verse 14. Make you an ark of gopher wood. Room shall you make in the ark, and shall pitch it inside and outside with pitch. So I know that a lot of I think the average length of the largest ships in the ancient world was something like 300 feet. And that's really reaching the extreme of a wooden ship, okay? And in those days, because they had to, they had to use pitch to keep it from leaking, and they had to use iron slats to keep the boards together. Any vessel that large is simply prone to leaking, And the ark, as I understand it, was over 450 feet in length. That ark was not designed to float for a very long time, was it?
Evidently not, because a 450-foot wooden vessel is huge and 75 feet wide.
Yeah.
And another 45 feet high, that is a huge vessel. That would be an awfully expensive large building today.
That's right. And something that large made out of wood would be extremely susceptible to being broken up in a violent storm. And, you know, so obviously it wasn't designed to last a really long time, and it wasn't designed to navigate oceans. And if you believe that the water went to the top of Mount Everest, that would have been, first of all, it would have killed everything on the planet. Every land animal on the planet that wasn't in the ark would have been killed.
Well, that's why he put the animals on the ark. Didn't you know there were elephants and polar bears?
Yeah, right. Yeah, and ants for the anteaters.
Yeah, the Catholic version of the flood, the mainstream version of the flood is ridiculous.
It's just plain ridiculous, yeah. And, you know, and the fact that we've been fed this, you know, indoctrinated with this, you know, we simply haven't thought about it. You know, when you actually think about the, you know, well, how did it get rid of the waste? How did it supply all the food? You know, you're talking literally millions of animals.
Well, the logistics are absolutely impossible.
Yes.
And the Catholic will tell you, oh, well, don't you believe God's a good to anything? And that's their answer to
it. Yeah, right. Don't you believe the Pope is infallible? No.
That is their answer.
Yeah.
God can do anything, and it happened.
Yeah, but Noah couldn't.
They insist it happened.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's a very childish mentality.
It is. It is a very childish point of view. And this is the fashion which you shall make of it. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits and the breadth 50 cubits and height 30. So, you know, going into the description of this. And, you know, what we're talking about here is either you believe this story, which makes absolutely no sense whatever, and you have to impute all kinds of miraculous energy from God to make this thing float and hold literally millions of animals like zebras and platypuses and, you know, what are some of the Australian animals, kangaroos. How did they get the kangaroos from Australia to put them on the ark?
Well, you even believe in evolution.
Yeah.
There was a titmouse on the ark, and some titmice after the flood.
Oh, okay. Oh, I see.
And they became kangaroos.
Right.
And I've heard people try to claim that.
Yeah.
I mean, not in those exact words, but I've heard people postulate on that.
Yeah.
And what they don't realize is that the titmouse we know for 4,000 years now hasn't changed a bit.
Right.
And the flood is only maybe 5,000 years ago.
Yeah. And what about the hippos and the alligators and the crocodiles and the snakes?
He was told, and I think that this was all done as an example to us, but, you know, every pocket of the earth has its unique flora and fauna.
Right.
At least at one time and still to a great extent today. And he saved, or he was told to preserve for one reason or another,
yeah,
the fauna from this particular area.
Right.
Which still hasn't been positively identified either. I mean, we have theories,
yeah,
and we could discuss that, but it hasn't been identified with any sense of where I would exude confidence over the identification.
Right. Yeah.
He was told to preserve actually not two of every type of animal, but seven of every clean animal. And two of every type of unclean animal.
Right.
And for some reason, that was Yahweh's command, him to preserve the fauna of that particular area.
Right. Right, yeah. And so, therefore, you know, you have more of the clean animal because those are more valuable. So, and obviously, you're talking, you know, probably, you know, cattle and sheep and the type of animals that civilization, you know, in that stage, at that date, depended upon. So I'm sure that's what it's talking about here. And, you know, and finally, if you actually believe that all this volume of water clipped the top of Mount Everest, there wouldn't be any saltwater fish surviving an event like this, because you're talking about billions of tons, if not trillions of tons of fresh water that the saltwater fish require salt water. and they die in fresh water. Just so, folks, it's a myth. It's an absolute myth. We have
problems, and the result of it would be
I mean,
never recover from
it. Right, yeah, and there wouldn't have been a live twig branch, for the dove to find, because anything that was still on the earth, for 5-6 months would have drowned. It could do it a drowned.
The source of the problem in many minds for the flood is the 6-day creation.
Okay.
That they see the creation as 6 literal days.
Yes.
And because we have found mollusk shells and things like that that definitely dwelled in the sea at one time.
Yes.
In the mountain ranges, then the flood had to cover the whole planet. Because the Earth was only created 6,000 years ago.
Right.
And the only thing that could explain mollusk shells in the Andes is a worldwide entire planet flood.
Yeah.
And in truth, the 6 days of Genesis are really 6 ages.
Right.
The planet is very old.
Yeah.
And it's very plausible that at one time, those mountains were under an ocean.
Of course, yeah. And plus, those layers, those strata, aren't uniform. You have mountain ranges where these strata are at 45 degree angles and sticking up through the earth,
being pushed up.
Yeah. And then there's strata underneath those. Clearly, when you see this kind of formation, you see all these strata that clearly go far beyond 4000 BC or whenever the flood was. I think the general consensus around 3200 to 3500 BC.
From the Septuagint chronology, it would be about 3245 BC.
Okay. And so if that's the case, how did there hasn't been a worldwide, the Everest Mountains and the Rocky Mountains, they had these strata already there before this flood happened, okay?
Absolutely.
So this creationist business is a lot of hokum. Gary, you're on the line?
Yeah.
Okay, you got a question.
I've listened to this argument. I've heard this argument so many times, and you and I shared this too once before. If there's three issues here. First issue, of course, we know during the time of Peg Leg, I think his name was.
Peleg.
There was a separation of the
continents. That must be where Peg Leg got his name from.
Well, I would say that there was a separation of the continents during the time of Peleg.
Wait a minute. Before you go into the explanation, Bill, I'm going to give you two more so you guys have something to talk about.
Okay.
Because Bill's great on the way he explains things. I really like it, Bill. I really
do. All right. Go ahead.
And when Bill's always having his little time to explain John 3:16 to me, I'd like to hear that one. But anyway, going back to what I was going to say is, and that's number one. Number two, you have all these so-called animals all throughout the world. You have to feed them.
Yes.
Okay, that's number one. And what does food do? The body is a food processor, so there's another end of the food chain that has to be taken care of, too. Who shoveled all that out?
Right, right.
So
if there are only 8 people to do all of this, that's quite a chore.
Right. So, those are issues that I never hear them talking about.
Right.
You have to use logic with it. Somebody told me, well, God just shrunk them all up into little one-inch things and put them on there. Wait a minute.
That's a good one. I haven't heard that one before.
they go through anything to make it work.
Exactly.
This program.
Yeah.
First of all, like you said, you have all these animals, okay? And Bill made mention, which is true, that you had 8 of a kind of the clean ones.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody already made this ark once before. Try and fit every type of animal in this world in that ark that's already made over in Europe someplace right now.
Yeah.
It ain't going to happen.
Yeah.
After you try to fit all them animals in there, now you got to get, because that ark was in the air for 1 year, now you got to fit all the food to feed these out. Well, yeah, God made them have a fast for a year. I know.
Right.
So then you got to clean up the manure behind this.
Mm-hmm.
Then after you start thinking about that for a minute, then you have to go back to what you just what Bill just said.
Okay.
That you have a dove out there. It might have been you. And he comes in with this olive branch. Where do you get this olive branch? Olive trees don't do good in salt water.
Right. That's right. Or on mountaintops.
And then all of a sudden, if you put trees underwater for a whole year, they're going to rot.
Right. They're going to die. Absolutely.
So there is no olive branches out there. Everything is barren.
That's right.
Where did this dove get this olive branch?
Yeah.
I mean, you go through all this and you go, God, how did all this happen? And God's going to say, you're so stupid, you don't pay attention to what I'm saying.
But Gary.
Well, the olive branch was probably an olive twig.
Mm-hmm.
And it had to bloom recently.
That's right.
Because it had to be tender enough for a dove, and who isn't going to pick an olive branch up in its beak. I mean, that's a
right.
poor rendering of the word.
Yes.
It was probably a freshly bloomed olive twig that the dove, and that's a an indication to know that if the trees are blooming, then it's relatively safe
mm-hmm.
to go out in onto the land.
Yeah, yeah.
Or Bill, not all the land was flooded, okay, where he went and picked to show Noah that, you know, you could go out there.
Well, absolutely. But as Eli said, the rain was probably bad enough that it destroyed all of the vegetation in a wider geographical area.
Oh, sure.
Where only a local land had been flooded to the point where everybody in it was destroyed.
I know, everybody has different concepts on which land it was,
right,
you know.
Right, and that's why I'd rather not get into that argument. There's the two leading concepts, I believe, that have the most credibility are either the Tarim Basin region or the Black Sea region.
I agree with the Tarim Basin. I don't know about the Black Sea. It's the first time I ever heard of that one, but I know I'll be hearing more about it from you and Eli. But and also, you know, you might talk about and explain to me how can they feed all these animals and clean up all the manure for them. I mean,
right.
That's a lot of animals that you got to put in that little tiny yard.
Hey, the entire personnel of the Chicago Zoo would not be able to do that.
Well, you mean Ron Mignol?
Yeah, right.
They won't fit in there?
Exactly.
He'd be part of the unclean, so you only get two of them.
Yeah. Okay.
I would like to comment on Peleg.
Yes.
And I didn't plan on commenting on Peleg until we covered Genesis chapter 10, where Peleg's first mentioned.
Okay.
However,
but it seems to be appropriate here. Yeah.
I'm compelled to do so here. If you look at the Septuagint text chronology, the Septuagint chronology is much more in accordance with, first, natural reality, and second, archaeology, and third, history,
mm-hmm.
than the Masoretic text chronology is. And the Masoretic text chronology has Shem dying at the same time practically that Abraham was born.
Okay.
10 generations later, 12 generations later, whatever. It's incredible that Shem nor any of the other patriarchs are mentioned during the life of Abraham, except for his immediate father and grandfather, yet they were all supposed to be alive at this time.
Okay.
Shalah, Heber, Peleg, Ru, Serug, Arphaxad, Canaan. If you believe the Masoretic chronology, they were all alive at the same time, yet none of them are mentioned in the account with Abraham.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just incredulous.
Yeah, okay.
Septuagint chronology, if anybody wants to see the two chronologies compared, they're posted on the Internet at Clifton Emmaheiser's website, emmaheiser.crystalgenia.org. On a page that says chronology, it's on the main navigation bar. It's easy to find. Now, Peleg was born, according to the Septuagint, 2,791 years after the creation of Adam.
Okay.
Shem was born 2,162 years after. Now, Arphaxad was born to Shem after the flood.
Okay.
2,262 years after. Now, Peleg's born 530 years after Shem.
Okay.
According to the Septuagint chronology. Therefore, the dividing of the land associated with Peleg can't have anything to do with the flood that happened 600 years before he was born.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
So if you get the chronology right, you'll see that that's a ridiculous supposition.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is that Peleg was born shortly after the Genesis chapter 11 event and the dividing of the land from Babylon.
Okay.
When they were all together in Babylon.
Yes.
That's what the division of the land under
right,
Peleg
right. So it's not talking about the dirt, earth, or continents. It's talking about the division among people.
Your family, you go live over there, and our family will come
that's
live over there. Right. That's what it's talking about.
Didn't they pick up huge continents and move them?
Well, you can see now, by the way it reads in the Masoretic, it sounds like the land was separated. As a matter of fact, when my son was alive, he mentioned that to somebody just by reading it. So it's fooled a lot of us into thinking that.
Well, I've met 500,000 people that believe that.
Yeah, well, and I'm even Indian, and I believe it, and I'm two seed line. I believed it.
Well, all I did was read it, and it just hit me in the head like a brick. I mean, go read the Bible and read it in context. And picture things as you're reading. I mean, it's a big difference when you read carefully and think about what each of those statements could mean, all the different things, and which one makes the most sense. And I don't know, it's common sense to me that because we have the Genesis chapter 11 event about the same time that Peleg's born, that must be what that's talking about.
Well, see, the only reason I said that was if there was a separation of the continents, then that would certainly call, you know, for the rising of the mountains because it sort of pushes it together, and it would show that some of those were at sea level and it's pushed them right up. That's why I mentioned that. But you put a different light on it, which does make it a little different, okay?
Continental drift happens, and it happens at a rate of a couple of millimeters a year.
Mm-hmm.
A continent moves. And a couple of millimeters is not very much a year. And for a continent to move from, first, if you understand plate tectonics, it's absolutely impossible for a continent to move because all the other plates on the Earth have to move with it.
Yeah.
In harmony, and they all have to go somewhere. And then what happens to the water? And if you take a surfboard and put it in your pool, and try to push it as fast as you can across the surface of the pool and watch what happens to the water. There would be nothing here if that ever happened.
It would get a little excited, the water would. The other thing that I wanted to share was when you read in the New Testament, there's quotes of the Old Testament. If you go to the Septuagint, it's almost word for word. But if you go to the Masoretic, it's not.
Well, I understand that because I read Greek and I've read all the Greek of the New Testament, and probably a great deal of the Greek, I hate to say most of it, but that's possible, of the Septuagint.
Yeah, I was just saying that to show how the difference in the two translations, the Masoretic and the Septuagint, how the Septuagint, you know, I'm agreeing with you, is a lot better translation and gives a lot more because it even goes in line with the quotes that the New Testament uses quoting the Old Testament. So what I'm doing is I'm supporting your argument there.
Well, right, and the New Testament absolutely supports the argument. The New Testament was definitely the book of Paul. The Septuagint was definitely the book of Paul and the other apostles, and it was definitely the book of Luke, the Old Testament, which Luke used.
Wait a minute, Bill, you're telling me the Catholic Church wasn't there yet?
and the other apostles, even though they were all familiar with I have to say, Hebrew texts which aren't part of the Septuagint tradition that we know of, you know, that because some of the New Testament quotes do diverge quite a bit, and so do the Aramaic Targums, and some of the New Testament quotes actually are closer to the Aramaic Targums or actually a little closer to the Masoretic text reading. However, most of the quotes in the New Testament of the Old are word for word from the Greek Septuagint.
Right, right. Okay, well, do we need to discuss the flood anymore? Shall we proceed to
go ahead. I'm just going to listen to you guys.
Okay.
I enjoy what you guys have to say. I just wanted to interfere and let everybody know I'm here.
All right. Thank you, Gary.
God bless.
God bless. Bill, any thoughts further on the flood, or can we go into Chapter 9?
I'm sorry. I'm just totally off the track with the notes that I had.
But the beginning of chapter 9 actually has some law in it. Verse 6, whoso sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. So this is obviously their law before it was given to Moses. And, of course, there was law given to Adam as well. They were told not to partake of that family tree in the midst of the garden or throughout the garden. So we know that there was a law existing, and it just isn't spelled out in the Holy Word, you know, until much later. But I think we pretty much covered the subject of Noah's flood. Okay.
This there's evidence in the book of Exodus before the law was given that they their ancestors had had laws.
Yes.
And they were considered to be God's laws.
Right, right.
And it's indubitable that the law handed down to the nation of Israel in Exodus is not the first law of God.
Right.
It's a special law, part of a special covenant that he made with the Israelites for a special purpose.
Exactly.
And,
exactly.
And it had a beginning date and it had an expiration date.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Daniel gives us the expiration date, basically.
That's right.
And I'm not saying that God's law is done away with. What I'm saying is that the national laws given to the Israelites were fulfilled, and we'll get into that more when we discuss the book of Rome.
Right, yeah. And certainly the blood rituals, those were certainly done away with. Yes.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes, okay. All right, so let's go into Genesis chapter 9, because we want to trace the descent of the various sons of Noah here, okay? Verse 18, and the sons of Noah that went forth of the ark were Shem and Ham and Japheth, and Ham is the father of Canaan. These are the three sons of Noah, and of them was the whole earth overspread. Now, of course, here's another example of the word Eretz, and certainly they didn't spread over all seven continents, did they?
No, it means the whole land.
Yes, and right.
It means the whole land throughout the context of the Bible.
Yes.
There are words which we use very widely today that were conceived in a very narrow sense then.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have a picture of the whole planet. I mean, there are ancient people that knew that the planet was a sphere, and they knew that there was a lot of land outside of their little world.
Yes.
But they still didn't consider that land a part of their world.
Right, sure.
And that's the sense in which the Greeks used the term oikoumene, just happens to be, and it's translated world, And I have to keep resorting to Luke chapter 2 because it's the most glaringly obvious use of it in the Bible.
Uh-huh.
Caesar went out and issued a decree that the whole world would be taxed.
Right.
Now, the Romans didn't sail across the sea and go try to tax the Japanese.
Right.
We know the Japanese were there in those days.
That's right. That's right. And they didn't have any money in those. They didn't have
right.
any yen.
And that world is that word is oikoumene, and that's living space. And,
yeah.
And that's the way the word earth or land is perceived.
Right.
In the Old Testament through Hebrew
right.
eyes is their living space.
It means the land in which they lived.
Yeah, the area in which the children of Adam dwelt.
Yeah. Right. Right.
And that's also the Garden of God, and Ezekiel describes that as the Garden of God. The children of Adam are the Garden of God.
Uh-huh.
Assyrian was the tallest tree in the Garden of God.
Right,
and
right.
The Garden of God is the white race in that area at that time.
Yes.
That's where the white race dwell. They're Adam, and they are the Garden of God,
yes.
Metaphorically.
Yes, certainly, certainly. Okay. All right, verse 20. And Noah began to be a husbandman. And he planted a vineyard. This sounds like we can take it very literally. Verse 21. And he drank of the wine and was drunk. And he was uncovered inside his tent. Now, we talked about the word nakedness already with respect to Genesis chapter 2 and the nakedness of Adam and Eve and how that their nakedness was revealed after they sinned, so therefore implying a sexual sin. And here again we have nakedness being uncovered. Verse 22. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brethren outside. All right. Well, let me just continue through verse 23. And Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it upon both their shoulders and went backward and covered the nakedness of their father, and their faces were backward and they saw not their father's nakedness. Okay, so what's going on here? Because there's more to this story than meets the eye.
Well, first, let's talk about reality in ancient society. Men didn't really leave the camp and wander off alone, and women especially did not leave the camp and wander off alone.
Right.
A man or a woman wouldn't go down to the riverside and take off all his clothes and bathe unless he had some of his brothers around him.
Right.
It was common for men to see each other naked.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with the boys actually seeing their father himself naked.
Mm-hmm.
Men did it all the time. People washed up in rivers. People washed up in that's ancient society.
Right.
In Greek society, you constantly see throughout Greco-Roman writings women in groups at a stream or at a pond, and there's nobody else around, and it's not lawful for a man to approach them.
Right.
And they're washing and they're doing their laundry and they're bathing themselves all at the same time. And that's the way people worked in those days.
Right. They didn't have showers.
Right. They didn't have private bathroom stalls and showers and the things, the amenities that we have today.
Right.
And that's the way people lived. And there would be nothing wrong with the boy seeing their father himself naked.
Yes.
And I know I've met Amish people today that insist on not seeing each other naked, the men.
Okay.
And it's a great sin to see your father naked, and that's because they misinterpret this episode.
Right.
Leviticus 20:11 says very explicitly, "And the man that lieth with his father's wife hath uncovered his father's nakedness."
Mm-hmm.
Period.
Yeah.
That's what Ham did.
Yeah.
That's Ham's sin. He uncovered his father's nakedness. That's the only way to logically and reasonably explain why Canaan, Ham's oldest, Ham's youngest son, and not Ham's other son, Cush and Mitzrayim, they weren't cursed.
Right.
Canaan was cursed. Ham's youngest son was cursed.
So
that is why.
So the result
of this relationship.
This expression, the nakedness of his father, is a metaphor or an idiom for actually meaning the nakedness of Noah's wife.
It's really a euphemism.
Okay.
It's a nice way to say that Ham slept with probably his mother.
Okay.
I mean, we have Jerry Springer today because people are still doing those things.
Right. Okay, it's only telling us in verse 21 that Noah was drunk. We can probably assume that his wife was drunk too, and maybe Ham as well. Okay.
Oh, I'm certain.
Mm-hmm.
Wine is a powerful cause for sin.
And so as a result of this, and many people who had experience with alcohol know that they've done things under alcohol that they wouldn't otherwise do, and that's what happened here.
I would believe so.
That's what happened here.
I have a problem being persuaded with that.
Yeah, so in other words, Canaan is the product of incest.
And that's why Canaan is cursed.
That's
there's no other reason why Canaan should be cursed, unless Ham and all his sons were cursed.
Right.
But only Canaan specifically is cursed.
Yes, yes. Okay. And certainly incest is not, Gethsri, was she necessarily his mother? Yes, because it's the euphemism or idiom, the nakedness of his father is, and you have to understand, in those days, women were actually considered the property of the husband, okay?
Yeah.
So it means her nakedness is his nakedness. Her nakedness belongs to him, okay? And that's why this idiom or euphemism means Noah's wife. That's what it means, okay?
And there were only